Let's go back to the phones. Thomas in Spartanburg, South Carolina, east of the Rockies. Thomas, thank you. And what's your story for us?
Hey, George. It's good to be with you tonight.
You too.
I had a friend of mine that moved away to San Diego, and before he left, he gave me a letter. He told me to read it. He was the kind of guy that had a gloomy disposition, seemed to have a cloud over his head. And so I opened up the letter, and it read as follows. I decided to go to the little rural area I grew up in. I hadn't been back since I was a little boy. My father was a policeman in that county, and he was killed in the line of duty when I was 12 years old, and I hadn't been back. I've forgotten how beautiful the land was, the Blue Ridge Mountains, winding roads, and clean, thin air. So I pulled into a little bed and breakfast that had been built where an old church had burned down. I got my key and drove around to the back to my cottage. I noticed an old caretaker quarters and a tool shed on the back corner of the lot. It was a real old place, and it struck me as strange that the bed and breakfast owners had not bulldozed the place down. But I got settled into my cottage and decided to build a fire in the fireplace as the sun and the temperature dropped. And I went down to the little woodshed to find some firewood, and I noticed a light on, and the dust was setting in, and the tops of the Blue Ridge appeared to be burning orange with the setting sun. As I got closer, I noticed someone was standing in front of the tool shed, so I stopped in my tracks, and I could barely make out in the gloom a person. I could see their hair and beard was almost fluorescent in the dim light. I said hello, and a man answered, and I found out his name was Roscoe, and he'd been the caretaker at the church there. After a while, he led me to the wood stacked on the side of the shed, and by his lantern, I gathered a full arm of wood, and I thanked him, and I could see him a little clearer now. He's a very old gentleman with wrinkled skin, snow-white hair. And he had a gleam in his eye, and for lack of a better word, he had a beatific smile and countenance. Well, I went back to my room and started a fire in the fireplace, and I sat down in the chair. I must have fell asleep. Then I awoke. The room was engulfed in smoke. I was choking and gagging, and a terrible fear and disorientation fell over me. I must have stumbled and fell, because the next thing I know, the old man, Roscoe, was pulling me out of the room. The first thing I became cognizant of was a powerful grip he had on my forearm. And the whole cottage was ablaze, even though he pulled me out rather quickly. I regained my equilibrium and turned to ask him if the fire department was on the way, and he was gone. Disappeared. Roscoe was nowhere in sight.
That's
so. I made my
story.
Way to the office, and the manager came out, and the fire department arrived almost immediately. And I sat in the office, and the manager came back in, and I asked him if Roscoe was okay. And the manager, whose name was Tim, just looked at me for a long time, and he asked me if I wanted something to drink. I said, "Yeah," and he got me a glass of water. And when Tim came back, he asked me to recall what had happened. And I told him as best I could that Roscoe pulled me out, pulled me to safety. And he wanted me to describe Roscoe. And I did, and he sat down beside me, and I mentioned the tool shed, and he looked at me perplexed and asked me if I was up for a walk. So we went to the back and walked down to the back lot, and there was no shed or building of any kind. I must have looked on the verge of a nervous breakdown, because Tim said that he wanted to show me something if I was up for it. So we walked down the back lot, and there was a trail we walked down until we came to an old graveyard. The graveyard was very old, and some of the graves were marked only with stones. And some of the gravestones were so weathered, the names were unreadable. But we came to one stone, and Tim stopped, and he obviously wanted me to read the tombstone, so I leaned over I could barely make out the name. And the tombstone read Roscoe T. Woods, 1901 to 1972. And Tim told me that Roscoe was killed by a policeman who he caught molesting his daughter.
Oh my.
In the shed beside the church.
And
Roscoe had killed him with a stick of stove wood, and in the altercation, they had knocked over the wood stove, and the place had burned down, and Roscoe had died in the fire.
Jeez.
And when I looked at Tim, I had one question. I asked him the name of the policeman, and it was my father's name.
That one's chilly. Thomas, thanks for sharing that with us. Not all of these stories end in a very happy way, but that one was, that's one of those awe-inspiring stories. Let's go to Mary in Naugatuck, Connecticut. Hi, Mary. Welcome to Ghost to Ghost.
Hi, George.
Hi.
You want my story now?
I sure do.
Oh, okay. It was about 10 years ago, my sister was diagnosed with stomach cancer. When they found it, it was already too late to treat it.
Oh.
And she was living in Mesa, Arizona, and I lived in Connecticut, so I flew out to visit her. And she was having a good day when I arrived in Arizona, and she wanted to go to Sedona. So we drove to Sedona and stayed overnight at a resort hotel. We had a lovely dinner on the terrace outside our room. And after dinner, we just sat on the terrace. It was a beautiful evening with this gorgeous full moon rising. And she had reached the point in her dying processes where she accepted her fate and she began to talk about it. And we discussed a lot of the theories about death and dying. And she said, if there's another side, she would try to find a way to let me know. So she passed 3 weeks later. We had a memorial dinner for her, and there were poster-sized photographs of her at various ages in her life. At the conclusion of the dinner, I was given a few of the photographs to keep. I took them home and emptied a bureau drawer and placed the photos flat on the bottom of the drawer so they wouldn't be bent or torn. And then I replaced the items that I had taken out. After a couple of weeks, one night, I had a dream that she was standing at the foot of my bed. She looked young and slim and healthy again. And she was teasing me because I hadn't been able to get comfortable on this feather bed mattress that she had given me. She asked if it was too technical for me. I had so many questions going through my mind, but I was too sleepy. I couldn't wake up enough, but I was just happy to see her well again. Upon waking in the morning, I felt warm and happy. It was like a heavy weight had been lifted off my shoulders. I swung my feet over the side of the bed and stood up. As I started to walk out, I stepped over the photos on the floor. I was thinking that I had better put them away before something happened to them. As I stooped down to pick them up, I realized that I had already put them away days ago. Then I remembered what she promised me in Sedona. If there was another side, she would find a way to let me know.
And she sure did, didn't she?
She did.
That's a great story, Mary. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Some of these are also very emotional, too. We go to Jay in Minneapolis. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the show. You're up with us, Jay?
George?
Yep, there you go.
Oh, okay. Jay in Indianapolis.
Yes, sir.
How you doing, George?
Good, sir. I'm good.
I've been listening since Father Malachi Martin was interviewed by Art Bell.
That's a long time ago. Well, happy Halloween, Jay.
Well, thank you very much, sir. It's a thrill to get your chance. Anyway, my story is about a house that, currently we're living in. My wife and my children are living in Indianapolis, but we moved here from Decatur, Illinois. We actually lived in a house there at the time. I was working at Archer Daniels Midland ADM, which I'm sure you know well.
I do.
I was building ethanol tanks out at ADM. My wife is a bartender. And we moved into this little yellow house on the street called Harrison Street. Well, the way that it worked is that we were renting the house from a retired police officer who lived directly next door to us on the corner, and he also owned the adjacent house to us. Anyway, been working at Archer Daniels Midland for about a year and a half now, and at this point, and worked elbow to elbow with this young kid every single day. Anyway, one day, I don't know what sparked the conversation, but we got talking about the house that I lived in. And he goes, wait a minute, what's the address? And I gave him the address, and he goes, you're kidding. He goes, we just had moved out of that house probably right before you guys moved in. And he had made the comment to me that, what have you had happen? And I didn't understand the question because we've never had anything supernatural happen. And I promise you, Jordan, your listeners that very night I went home. And I don't know, because it was embedded in my mind that he asked me that question. But things immediately started happening. Windows would open, shut by themselves.
Jeez.
Things would disappear. We'd lay something on the counter, go back to get it, be gone. My wife and I have four kids. Our oldest right now getting ready to turn 18 in December. Our youngest is four.
Yeah.
At the time, our middle boy, who is now 13, was just right about 3 years old. And he used to tell us that he would see the red man.
The red man?
The red man, as in a color red.
Yeah.
And things just got stranger and stranger. The way the house was set up, I'm not trying to be long-winded. I know you've got other callers waiting. The way that the house was set up was you walked in, it was a living room with the kitchen off to the side. You go back to the hallway. On the left-hand side was the bathroom, and then there was three bedrooms, two on the right-hand side and one directly in the back side of the house, which was, the two middle boys' rooms. One day, Julie, that's my wife, and I were standing in the boys' bedroom, and out of nowhere, we still to this day have no idea where it came from, a very large framing, 16 pennies a nail, came flying across the room and hit her right in the back of the head. It was shiny, brand new nail.
She did stick in her head, did it?
No, nothing like that. She didn't get hurt. But this thing really targeted her. A different time, we were standing in the same doorway. The linchpin, the bottom of the door, of the hinge, flew out of the door, right at her. And I put the thing back in, and I tried to make it come out with a hammer, and I couldn't get it to fly out. This time, I started doing EVPs in the house. And, you know, you might every once in a while get an EVP here and there. We got one every single time.
You've got to get some of these to us, Jay, if you can. We're almost out of time here for the break, but definitely try to get some of those sounds to us. Email them to me at george@coasttocoastam.com. Lisa in San Diego. A couple minutes left, Lisa. Go ahead.
Okay. So I like to dance and listen to music. And a few years back, I lived in a condo that had very thin walls, and it was summertime. It was nighttime. And so I went up to this park that's about a block away from me and to listen to my music and dance. And so I went up there and I was listening, and then I got out of my car and I started dancing, and I was totally into the music. And then I looked up towards the bathrooms where there are these like 20 feet high, tall light posts. And right under the lamppost, there was this disco man, and he was all black, and he had bell-bottom pants, and he had a disco suit on, like Saturday Night Fever, kind of. And he was dancing with me, and he was flipping, and I felt like he was kind of making fun of me. And so I stopped dancing, and I was watching him, and his legs and his arms were flipping up, like folding in half, faster and faster. And I just started getting this really weird feeling, like, I don't know, it just got faster and faster. So I jumped into my car and I backed up and I shone my headlights right on him, and he was still moving really fast, but he started fading back from my headlights and just disappeared.
Huh. Into thin air.
Well, yeah, it was really scary.
You're lucky he didn't grab you, Lisa, and take you away. You got to be careful with that. All right. Well, we're going to continue with Ghost to Ghost here. Fast night, by the way. It is just rolling along. By the way, this weekend, we've got Dave Schrader hosting on Saturday. And then I'll be right back on Sunday with emerging artists and, of course, a very special interview for you as well. And then we'll get your week going once again on Coast to Coast AM. So let's get ready for more your ghost stories. Let your fingers do the walking and make the call. I'm George Dory, back in a moment on Ghost to Ghost and Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's time for our traditional shout-out, and thanks for supporting Coast to Coast AM. Those of you listening to our favorite radio stations across North America, 600 strong, thank you so much. Coast Insiders, thank you. And then Sirius XM Indy Channel 102. Again, thanks for listening to Coast, all of you. And then the Imaginative Worlds, Into Infinity, National Radio Club, the MySpace groups, not a lot of those anymore, but those who follow us on Facebook and Twitter, Northern Kentucky Paranormal Group, Above Top Secret, SoCal UFO Meetup Group, the Hollywood Ghost Hunters, the Nighthawk Nation, and Greg the Cook in St. Louis. Thanks for supporting Coast to Coast AM. Emails in, of course, during the break. And one of our listeners said, how do we know that that was JC who called and that he's really dead and that was a ghost of JC? I guess we really don't. Back to the phones we go. Let's go to Wenatchee, Washington. John's with us, west of the Rockies. Happy Halloween, John.
Hey, happy Halloween, George. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing great also.
Okay.
Hey, this is a true story.
All right, I believe you. Go ahead.
All right. The year was 1969. Back then, I lived in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on West Baker Street, and I was in the eighth grade. After school one day, me and my neighbor friend, we were in my house. We were alone, and we were talking about spirits, as my house had a few of them. He let me know that he absolutely did not believe at all in spirits, at all. We discussed it round and round and argued about it, and finally he just came out and said, well, just prove it. And I said, okay. See that closed closet door at the far side of the other room? He said, yeah, what about it? Well, I was feeling very confident, and I pointed at the door and said, by the power of the spirits in this house, I command this door to open now. And the door immediately slammed open hard and fast. And, boy, we both ran out of the house just yelling, finally stopping in the front yard. And I said, don't ever make me prove that to you again. And he was white as a ghost then. So spirits do help us out in the strangest ways sometimes, even if it is just to prove a point.
They sure do. Hey, thanks for the call. Alex, Midland, Texas, first-time caller. Alex, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Good evening, Mr. Norrie, and happy Halloween, sir.
Well, you too, Alex.
I kind of got a haunting slash possession thing going on. Me and my wife moved into an apartment after we got married, and we were filling up the house with little odds and ends, and I came across a photo online of a bunch of flowers that had been x-rayed. And I work in the hospital as a nurse, and my dad has worked 20 years as an x-ray tech, so I've seen these flowers before, and I was just drawn to them. So we get them in the house, and everything's going good, and slowly we start to notice that, you know, little things out of the corner of our eyes and, you know, little odds and ends going on like that, and didn't think much of it. And as time progressed, you know, the covers would come shooting off the bed, and, you know, nothing that we've not experienced before. I've had years of encounters, so to say. And one night, my wife decided that she was going to leave her phone out and record. And so we wake up the next morning and listen, and you hear this loud smack. And it goes, "Who is this?" And then the phone cuts off. And so I show it to my friends thinking, oh, look what I caught. And so the next evening, my wife is preparing dinner, and a wine bottle comes shooting off the top of our fridge, almost hits her and goes flying into our dining room. So I say, you know what, that's enough. I'm going to perform a clearing on the apartment, and sat down in the middle of a large living room and, you know, told everything to leave. Well, I had all the windows closed and all the sliding glass door closed, and there's this rush of constant foot trampling going by, and then it gets quiet. And I'm sitting there, and I hear somebody come behind me and go, "I am he." And the sliding glass door opens. That was locked. So things calmed down, and after a little while, we decided to move into a house because, you know, it started to stir up again. And so I started looking into the apartment. Come to find out, a bunch of prisoners were being transported out from an airport that was across the street. And the plane had problems, turned around, and crashed in the exact same building we were living in. So we thought, okay, that explains the anger. And, you know, as a couple months go by, we find the house, we're starting to move in, and something violently pushes me off about half of the steps going down, because we lived on a second floor apartment, and I twist my ankle and have to go to the ER, and I get better, and we keep moving, and we take this photo down that we had bought. And I set it by the front door, and I start freaking out. I don't want to get rid of it, and I wasn't going to. And I run outside, and I call my mom. I said, something is wrong. And so she comes running over, and my dad starts praying for some reason. And I just get angry, and I don't want anything to happen to the picture. And he goes, "I am taking this outside, and we are getting rid of it." And he sets it by the trash, and everything stopped. And the house was calm, and it was pleasant again, and everything was fine.
And what do you think? What do you think caused that?
I have no idea. I believe that the photo was from the X-ray department at our local hospital. I mean, that's why I fell in love with it. I loved those flowers. And working in the hospital and being around those people for all the time that my dad has worked there, you know, I've seen the photos before, but how many people have seen those flowers before being diagnosed with terminal cancer or
exactly.
being told they don't have much time to live and grasping onto that picture, that last little echo that they have? And it's horrifying.
Compelling story. Alex, thanks for sharing that with us. We'll go to Emily now in Phoenix, Arizona. Emily, happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. How are you?
I'm great. So do you have a great story for us?
I do. I grew up in a small town in southern Arizona, about 15 minutes away from the Mexico border. In the neighborhood that I grew up in, it was called Miracle Valley, and it was called this because a group from Chicago had come down. It was a religious group, and they purchased a large chunk of land separated by the highway. Half of it was Dave's neighborhood, and the other half was built a really big Bible college. And in 1982, there was a Miracle Valley massacre. Basically, these people who had come from Chicago and opened this Bible college were kind of setting their own laws and, I guess, a little unsanitary. There were some sicknesses. They weren't taking kids to the doctors. So the Cochise County residents had gotten the deputies involved. One thing is, in 1982, there were the deaths of a few of the people who had come, the religious fanatics, and about and so years later, after that happened, long after illegal in this neighborhood.
Oh, you're breaking up, Emily. So let's see if we can get a better connection with you. Where are you?
Am I here?
Yeah, you're here, but you're breaking up a little bit. So we gotta make sure we can finish the story with you. Are you walking around or what? No, and it's not gonna work. Ah, try to get a better line. Okay, well, let's go to Shepherd Mission, and let's go to you, Doc. Welcome to the program, Doc. You're on the air with us.
Thanks a lot, George. I was a hospital corpsman with 1st Track Vehicle Battalion in 1984, and we were in Korea, and I was with a tank company, and we were Delta Company, and we were heading north of Hyeonggi Mountain Range, and we were probably about 2 or 3 clicks from the DMZ, I'd say, and they had these little cracker box type little tiny food stores where you buy all like moon pies and stuff like that and ramen noodles and whatever. And there's usually 2 Korean people in there selling food, you know, or whatever. These huts are only about 16 foot by about maybe 12 foot long or something. And they're about 6-7 foot high, but we were all going in concession. There was about 9 or 10 tanks of us, tanks. And first 3 people didn't see this, but the third tank behind the commanding officer's tank saw this guy leaning right up against the hut. He had 1950 Korean War style fatigues on. He had the brown looking ugly boots and the olive drab shiny type helmet, and he had a white bandage over his head, and they had blood on the bandage, and he was around his arm was slung an M1 Garand. So the guy on the staff sergeant on tank says, "Get out there, Doc. There's something wrong with that guy. You got to get out there and help him tonight." And he was in our tank stop right in front of the hut. And the guy looked right at me, you know. And the staff sergeant says, "Man, get in there and help that guy." He walked into the hut, right? Okay. He walked in. You still there?
Yep.
Okay. He walked into the hut. We all walked in right behind him. And the other one surrounded the back so he couldn't get out the back door. Well, we walked in behind him, and he was not there. There was nothing there. The guy was gone, and we're asking the Korean guys, "Where'd the guy go with the bands on?" He said, and they all looked at each other kind of funny and looked at us and said, "Oh, you see him too. What happens once in a while," they said. "Happens once in a while. He's from Korean War. He's from war a long time ago.
Wow.
He still hangs around here, you know." They didn't think like it was nothing, you know. We were all seeing it, and it disappeared right in front of us. I was like, and you knew it was from Korean War, Eric, because of the way that the olive drab fatigues and helmet that he had on, the brown boots, and the M1 Garand told me it was like 1950. You know,
that's a great story. Just makes you shake your head, doesn't it?
Oh yeah. Well,
next
anniversary of the Navy and Marine Corps coming up there, George.
Oh, it sure is. Absolutely. Hey, Doc, thanks. Appreciate it. Let's go to Greenville, South Carolina. Frank's turn on Coast to Coast. Frank, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Okay, George, happy All Hallows.
You too.
And this happened to me about four. I'm 63 years old. And one of my bucket lists was that I was going to take a trip in Arkansas from the Saline River west of Little Rock, which, if you've ever seen the movie Sling Blade, that's the bridge he was standing on up there was the Saline River.
It was a great movie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wonderful movie. So I ended up actually standing underneath that bridge looking up at him, or where he was at that point in the movie. Okay, the Saline River is got some Class 3 rapids on it, and I'm in a canoe all by myself. And my intent, like I say, was to go all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. My wife was going to pick me up 3 months later. Okay, I end up sort of off the edge of the river, and I'm thinking, oh, great, I've messed up here. And I end up bottlenecking in a place where there was a bunch of trees that were piled up in the river, and the river literally came to a stop there. So I have no choice other than get out of my canoe, unload some of my equipment, and carry it around the blockage, and then drag my canoe along the left side of the bank. Well, it was on sand. I mean, it wasn't going to hurt the canoe or anything. And all of a sudden, this circle opens up in front of me. Now, I wasn't drinking. I wasn't doing any drugs, anything like that.
Right.
This was a circle about 10 or 12 feet in diameter, and you've seen a kaleidoscope.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the edge of the circle looked like. And there were people walking out of it. And as they walked to me, they were saying something to me, and I could not understand what it was they were saying. It was like they were having a conversation, but I couldn't quite understand the conversation. And they were disappearing as they got to me. Well, I passed out. This was within probably less than a minute's time that this happened. Oh, I've got a terrible scar across my face and eye from where I fell.
Jeez.
And I wake up 5 hours later on the river, still there with my canoe, all my stuff, you know. So I decide, well, I'm exhausted. That's what it's got to be. Okay. So I reload my canoe the next morning. I just went ahead and slept on the riverbank there. And I ended up right back onto the river. But the weird part of all this, that's not weird enough, I go to lay down that night, and I hear this music being played and this song. And it's like an old Negro ritual or church song. And it keeps saying, come in out of the rain. 2 days later, I have to be saved off of that river because it flooded. Majorly flooded. I had to call, and they had to have an airplane and helicopter come get me off the river.
Or you are history.
Or I would have been history. But I heard this song for two nights in a row. In fact, I thought I was going crazy. But they kept telling me to get in out of the rain. And once what had happened was a freak storm had come in west, come out of Oklahoma and Arkansas, and had flooded upstream, and I had no idea it was there, and all the water ended up coming downstream. Of course.
Jeez, I love that story. Look, those old revival songs are classics. And you must have had a bunch of dead spirits who are out there to try to save you. Let's take another quick call before the break, and we'll come back with more. Let's go to Jolynn in La Cañada, California. Hi, Jolynn. Go ahead.
Hi, George Norrie. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Well, good. I think I had experience with the afterlife.
What happened?
Well, I'll back up and I'll tell you a little bit. My son, he was a very patriotic, loving young man, and he had a lifelong dream of becoming a fighter pilot. So he joined the Marines and became an officer at 23. And then he went to Pensacola to train, and he got his pilot's license, and he soloed, and he was on his way to a really good future. But as the story goes, a girl offered him an OxyContin, and for whatever reason, he took it, and he liked it. It suited his chemistry. Oh. Yeah, and he got hooked, and when that became too expensive at $80 a pill, he switched to heroin, which was only $5 a bag. Yeah, and he got a DUI in Florida, and they sent him home, and we put him in Betty Ford, but he got kicked out after 2 months for hooking up with a girl. So he came home, and a week later, he died from an accidental overdose.
Oh, geez. Accidental, no suicide.
No suicide, just accidental. And so the first night that he died, I was lying in bed. The house was dark. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. My husband was asleep beside me. Nobody else was in the house. And all of a sudden, I heard a faint voice. It sounded kind of sickly and young, and it said, Mama, Mama. And my son used to call me Mama, and I thought maybe, you know, you're so, after, you know, your child dies, you have such grief. I thought maybe I was hallucinating.
Oh, sure.
It.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then the next night, I heard my son's deep voice say three words, but he was in a different part of the, it came from a different part of the house, and I didn't know what the words were, but it was just unmistakably his voice. And then
well, he definitely came back, Jolynn. He came back.